Welcome to episode 6 of Tailoring Tech and Talk with me, Roberto Rivilla. I'm a bespoke tailor, menswear designer and owner of Roberto Rivilla London Suit and Shirt Makers. I love clothes, business, creativity, tech and great design, so join me each week as I delve into my guests' passions and gain valuable insights into their professional lives. My hope is that you'll learn something new, meet some interesting people and be inspired to get involved. Who knows, it could even be you joining me as a guest. This week, I'm joined by Rob McCargo, Director of AI at PwC. Rob and I discuss how life and your career path don't always go as planned, the importance of embracing and learning from failure, our mental health challenges, what AI means in today's business world, and the future of work. We're also celebrating passing 500 downloads in our first month. So if you like what you hear, please remember to share this episode with your friends, family, and colleagues. Enjoy. This week, I'm joined by one of PricewaterhouseCoopers' rising superstars, a regular entrant in the social media global power top 10, media commentator, keynote speaker, including TEDx, an advisory board member of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on AI, an advisor to the IEEE Global Initiative on Ethics of Autonomous and Intelligent Systems, a fellow of the RSA, honorary visiting fellow at the Business School, formerly known as CAS, HR Magazine's most influential thinker, loving husband, amazing dad, slave to Rusty the Vizsla, and my friend, Rob McCargo. Rob, I'm truly honoured to have you join me today. How are you?
Bobby, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you here today, and I'm really well, thank you, as well as I can be, stuck in my prison cell at home.
We'll be getting you out of there soon. I can feel it. The whole country is slowly starting to wake up, so I think it's going to be a good late spring summer. I probably missed some achievements in that introduction, but first of all, as Google does, it brings up great memories from photo albums. And did you know that 15 years, this very day, 15 years ago this very day, you and I were together in the West End and I was conducting the try-on for your wedding suit?
That feels like a very, very long time ago. And what perfect serendipity it was to the day, 15 years. Hey, wow, what's happened since then? Amazing.
I know. I really don't know where the time's gone or where my hair went during that time. Let's talk about you first of all. Well, actually, let's just talk about you. That's why you're here. So you graduated from Newcastle University. You went straight into the world of recruitment. We met when you were at Michael Page. You became regional manager there, and then you went on to be a really big part of two new startups before taking some time out. You hit the reset button and did some volunteering in Sierra Leone with Plan International. I can't not talk about that period of your career and your life because you achieved so much at such a young age. You experienced so much, and there were so many valuable lessons that you obviously learned along the way that have shaped who you are now.
I think it's an interesting time to reflect back, and being stuck at home for the last year maybe it's given more time to reflect than before. I don't think I ever had a real plan. I'm very, very privileged now where people come to me for some input in terms of their career, some mentoring. I coach a lot of people. But the first thing I always say is, listen, do not, whatever you do, follow my path. I'll be honest. I think looking back, most of my career moves were a more or less an unmitigated disaster, lurching from one failure to the next. And I think that's an interesting word that I've learned to get comfortable with, the big F word, failure. So, you know, I don't think I was a particularly good recruitment consultant. I was middle of the rank. I was not an especially good entrepreneur. I wasn't particularly destined for the world of humanitarian aid. And I'm not even sure I'm particularly top of my game in what I do now. But maybe that's a bit of self-doubt creeping in. But one thing I do know is that I think I've learned along the way that failure, it can be a good thing. And I think at those moments in time, it's not a case of parceling them away and ignoring them, but actually learning to love them, embrace them, and find that they're the greatest moments of personal growth. And I can absolutely look back fondly on various moments that I felt really bad at the time were, you know, really, really heavily impacting me. And I felt like a failure. So actually look back now positively and say, you know what, they were perfect for what I needed to go through to change, to grow and evolve.
I remember when you told me about your next career move, because I was really excited when you got back from Africa and there were things that were in the pipeline. And then you told me that you'd ended up at PwC. How on earth did that happen? And what do you do there? You're Director of Artificial Intelligence. What does that mean?
I remember finishing the Africa project, and I remember it in particular because Emma, my wife, said to me, that big news is about to happen. Baby number three is on its way, and uttered the immortal words to me, "Isn't it about time you got a grown-up job?" And I was thinking, I don't want a grown-up job. I want to do interesting things and save the world and do that sort of thing. So I thought, when I came round to the concept, I thought PwC sounded quite grown up, and very, very fortunate. A good mate of mine was working there, had worked there at the time, and introduced me around. So I came in into a sort of a HR type of role for the first year. One thing that people that have been through a phase in recruitment are bloody good at, though, is networking the hell out of an organization. And I suddenly had 300,000 people to network into immediately. And I can say with a high degree of confidence, you're in that same vein, Bobby, of course, as a master networker of your own right.
Well, don't forget, I almost ended up working with you at Michael Page when I was in my early, it was about 24, 25, and I'd got to a sort of stage where I either needed to try and make it in tailoring or do something else. And Michael Page actually called me with an offer. I'd actually gone to them to try and find me a job somewhere. And they came back and said, "We've got a job for you. We want you to join us." And I hesitated. And it was my hesitancy that then created the opportunity where I then went to Tom James, and the rest is history.
Yeah, a real sliding doors moment. And I think that's it for me, is I don't know many people that have a very, very clear view about a career plan. I just think you need to constantly find yourself in interesting situations, meeting smart people and being exposed to possibility. And that's what maybe coming back to a big corporate allowed me to do there. And ended up, you know, working eventually in a transformation team, looking at the people agenda of technology projects, and then into an AI project about 5 or 6 years ago. And the rest is history. And this was in a really interesting time 5 years ago, because AI, artificial intelligence as a subject, was starting to really gain a lot of traction in the UK and globally. Politicians were waking up to the impact of it. Regulators were concerned about the implications of it. It was surfacing real world issues in terms of opportunities and risks, ethical debates, and the world goes on. And as a major advisor to governments and businesses and the public sector, it was quite clear we needed a position on this. And that really was the role I forged out. So I've had a wonderful 4 or 5 years doing this role. It's seen me travel the world, meeting governments. I've met a few prime ministers. I've even met a few Hollywood stars. We'll come on to that moment a bit later on. But really, it's the purpose of the role is to bring together this holistic approach to how to adopt AI well in business, how to do this in a way that solves hard problems. It improves the lot of the workforce. It removes risk from business. But it also is done in a way that's responsible, that avoids that a sort of unintended set of consequences that can surface with this particular type of technology. So I work with, of course, the technologists, the data scientists, the machine learning engineers, but I work with HR advisors, regulators, ethicists, and beyond, both within PwC and beyond into the wider market.
It also seems to have got you working, or at least crossing paths with contemporaries at other firms.
I'd say there's definitely a lot happening collaboratively with the industry at large. So you mentioned at the start, I'm part of this all-party group on AI. So you are finding that there's a growing number of fora coming together to look at things like standards and ethical principles and the way that the market at large can adopt this well, and make sure that government have the right policy and you've got the right approach to working with the education system to look at skills. So I would say that of all the technologies, this is one that has seen quite a lot of interaction, collaboration and cooperation to ensure it's done well.
So I remember back to your first, I don't know if it was the first year or even just the first few months. So I come down to your offices to see you because you're talking about getting a couple new outfits and me needing to make you look like someone who knows what he's talking about, which to be fair, most of the time you do. The outfits I'm suddenly creating for you are for a TEDx talk. You're not just getting up to just talk in front of a few colleagues. All of a sudden, early on, you're straight through the door and you're doing TEDx.
Back to that point about having a plan. It's never a plan to be a public speaker or keynote speaker. It's one of these beautiful serendipitous moments. Back to that point about AI becoming such a hot topic. You know, we had a huge amount of interest across the market to have a ability to offer advice on this subject. And one thing led to another. A contact of mine also was invited to do one, I think, on cybersecurity, and knew there was an opportunity for an AI spot in the schedule, and introduced me in and got through the process. And before I knew it, I was hitting the red circle. And that was probably one of the most memorable processes I've been through. I've probably done 400 or 500 talks ever since that moment. But I still remember that one in particular because, you know, everyone watches TED Talks, don't they? You know, yeah. There's that 15 to 18 minute window. There's very, very specific rules around how it should be delivered. It doesn't follow the track of any other normal talk. You're not using lots of slides and PowerPoint presentations, thank God. But the prep was intense and it was immense. And the moment to actually let it out on the stage after that much rehearsal was a really quite, it's actually quite emotional, I'll be honest. It was quite a moving moment. You know, I was thinking back to key moments in my life that had led to me getting to that point where I could be on the stage. I was thinking back to, you know, having lost my mum and all the big changes I've been through. And suddenly I'm on the stage talking about this really cool subject. And as you might recall, my subject was about the future of AI with regards to the next generation. In my case, yeah. my kids. So it was quite nice to get into something quite personal. And after that, it just went crazy. You know, since then, the opportunities to speak about this just came flooding through the door. So I had a super interesting time in the last 4 or 5 years doing this. And thinking back to how then that brought me through to this moment, or maybe the sort of the pre-pandemic moment, it culminated almost exactly a year ago to this week, where I was at the Excel Centre on the stage in front of 5,000 people as the co-keynote speaker alongside the astronaut Tim Peake at major tech conference. It's like, what the hell is going on here? I thought, you know, this is just something I'd never planned for. Just super exciting, pretty nerve-wracking. And I remember coming off that stage and I got a photo with Tim, and it was just like out of this world in more ways than one. Before you knew it, the whole world had changed. Before I know it, was sent home. And the instruction to work from home had come through, and I was consigned to my home. And not only that, actually, Bobby, it was a week or two of sitting there thinking, you know what? I don't even know what I do for a living. I don't sit here staring at computer screens all day. I'm normally out and about on my feet, seeing people, seeing clients, and talking about my area. And to make matters worse, I then came down with COVID-19 and was hit pretty hard, not to the point of hospitalization, but I was wiped out for a good couple of weeks. So you can imagine the high coming right down to that crashing low, and rapidly thinking, God, what on earth do I do now? The entire way of life has been changed by that. But that's been a really interesting 4 or 5 year journey of attached to this world of AI.
I totally empathize with what you're saying about, you know, March last year, everything just changing within a matter of days. I mean, I remember, again, like you, I thrive on seeing people all the time. You know, that's what gets me out of bed every morning, is the fact I look at my diary and I've got 5, 6, 7 clients stroke friends that I'm going to be running around doing things for and spending time with and so on. And all of a sudden, I'm being told potentially that I'm never possibly ever going to do that again. It's the first time that I'd been shown a world where suddenly I don't get to do what I do. And I found it really, really tough to handle. And luckily, I think I've managed to escape the dreaded lurgy so far, touch wood. But I'd literally just come off the back of recovering from, you probably remember in January 2017, I was involved in a crash with a lorry. A lorry came through the back of my scooter when I was stopped at a zebra crossing. was quite a long road back. The physical recovery was a little quicker than the mental recovery. And to have just about come through that and then to be hit with this, it was really tough. I mean, I was done for the first 2 months of this. I think it wasn't until sort of late April that I had a few clients who called and said that they needed me. I won't go into all of it, getting quite emotional. And then I got my head out of the proverbial and looked around and thought, right, what can I do? People still are wearing clothes. I haven't seen anybody walking around naked yet. And that just got me back into action. But how did you deal with suddenly being cut off from people face to face and not being able to do this newfound thing that you were suddenly thriving on and you're absolutely brilliant at?
I think when you have been through some challenges, we've discussed this a lot, my friend, haven't we? You know, when you've grieved for close family members, when you've had things go wrong, where things haven't worked out well, where you've hit the buffers, then I think you learn a lot about yourself, don't you? And you learn a lot about things like the difference between pressure and stress. So I'm really, really intuitively understanding of myself now about the sort of pressure I actually need to get myself moving and activate myself and do something positive. But I've also felt the excruciating pressure of stress and even depression at moments in the past that I often speak about now quite openly. And I think the first thing I had to do was just reevaluate that moment back then to realize I've been through hard times, as many people have, and I've got a process to work through here. And that was really helpful to get through that. And then bit by bit, I've also realized, goddamn, I've reinvented myself enough times now. It's just a case of keeping on doing it. And then more or less at the same time, the whole world of Zoom conferences kicked off. I'm starting to, get into that way of life. It's not the same. I don't think it'll ever be quite the same as the real thing. But that kept me going for a while. But it just kept me allowing to reposition, pick up new projects and start thinking about the future. And we're now in that phase, aren't we? Looking into the year ahead and the years after, where we've got some really important work to do. We've got a fundamentally huge opportunity to totally transform the way of work. We've got technology now at our disposal that's being adopted at a pace it's never been adopted to before. Let me just give you one statistic that we did from a big survey last year. So we, 52% of businesses we surveyed last year said that they were directly accelerating their approach to automation because of what the pandemic has done to their business. So things that were on like the roadmap for companies many years down the track have been brought forward right now out of necessity and sheer survival. So what I think that has brought with it is this really interesting mix of possibility, opportunity, and huge innovation, but at the same time coupled with all these new sorts of risks and issues. And I think at the heart of that is the lot of your member of your workforce. How are they coping in these conditions? What does this mean for their well-being and performance? What does this mean for the very essence of social capital of people we're hiring? I keep thinking about the sheer number of graduates we hire. We're the UK's largest private sector recruiter of graduates. You know, we've had to pivot to hiring them virtually. We've used virtual reality to engage them. You know, there's been all these interesting opportunities to bring tech into the foreground. But it poses new challenges. How do we build that level of connectivity and collaboration? How do we build that level of experiential learning into the curriculum so that they're not too isolated and they're picking up the skills as fast as they can? So what we now have, I think, is different things we're seeing happening in the press, different narratives being referred to. We're hearing some stories of companies wanting as quickly as possible to dash back to the old normal, back to the way things were. We've already heard extraordinary stories of businesses deciding to entirely change their business model, do away with their real estate and property portfolio entirely. And we're hearing about this world of the sort of hybrid workforce as well. And we're also talking about what we call asynchronous work patterns with teams working, you know, at different times of the day. So this isn't, I don't think, ever going to be as straightforward as going from everyone in the office to now simply some people in the office and some people at home. it's far, far, far more complicated than that. There's so many situations that are surfacing with regards to culture, with regards to diversity, with regards to inequity in different parts of your workforce. Different issues and pressures and different sorts of impact in terms of wellness in your staff as well. And technology can impact that negatively and lead to a deleterious impact on workers, but it can also be adopted in a way that actually makes their life easier and gives them more utility and removes drudgery and friction from their lives as well. And to be part of that mission, which I'm very much am now in this role, is superbly exciting. So it took a bit of a dip and a bit of a reset to rediscover a bit of mojo, but I think we're cautiously looking forward to what we can do to change things for the better in the years to come in the world of business.
I always say to a lot of clients and their team members, when I speak out of turn, when I'm in people's offices and I overhear people moaning because there are certain challenges. So 2008 being one of them. And, we've been through some things through this decade, culminating in this COVID thing. And I always say that to them, people, your clients, customers, potential customers, they always have problems that need solving. When we go through things like this that have such a big impact, the problems don't go away. It's just the nature of them changes. So out of chaos, opportunities always present themselves. And certainly with the whole dialogue now around how people are going to be working in the future, and depending on the industry, like you said, some industries are going to be doing away with their commercial property portfolio altogether and move to remote working 100%. Others want to do exactly the opposite, particularly a lot of property companies that are involved in commercial office space, because it doesn't look very good if you've got your whole workforce working from home and you're trying to sell office or commercial space. And then there's the whole gambit of different types of companies and so on that are somewhere in between. Different law firms, depending on their specialisms, will again look to go to a hybrid model, or they'll want everyone back, or they'll want everyone working from home. It is such a complex issue. But the way that leaders make these decisions has got to be so considered. And from the work I've seen, not just you, but other colleagues and your peers within your industry doing, it's so important, because you're helping people to not make these knee-jerk decisions that are based on their own beliefs, old-fashioned beliefs and so on. I mean, really, they've got to be very analytical of their workforce and how they're feeling and what their practical situations are. Because working from home is not going to work for everybody. You take younger people who, I mean, I've done some wedding fittings during the pandemic, and I've had to largely see people at home. And you go into some of these places and they're flat shares and house shares with multiple occupants. The rooms are so small. You've got people who are having to go on a rotor system to take calls, walk outside while a colleague takes a call without being disturbed, and then they swap around. That's not always practical. Which brings me on to the hopes and fears survey that was released a few days ago. The thing I really loved about that is that it leads in with talking about mental health as the priority and how people are feeling, because there are a lot of people that are very scared out there now. There are some people that are unsure of what their place in the workforce is going to be in the future and whether they will need to make a significant career change. There are other people that are worried about how their company is going to implement workplace changes and how that's going to impact what they want and what they are hoping for going forward. But it, in comparison to recent surveys that have been bandied about that seem to just take a straw poll of anywhere from 100 to a few hundred people, and then the findings are kind of nonsensical, quite contradictory in a lot of cases, this looks like it was an absolutely huge undertaking, and it's going to be essential reading for key decision makers, no matter what industry they're in.
I think so, yeah. I mean, in terms of the sheer scale, we're talking 32,500 workers that we surveyed through this across many, many countries. So we hope it's going to be a useful addition to the body of evidence starting to come out as we move through to this next phase of recovery.
I think it's important to mention, sorry, Rob, I think it's important to mention as well that those aren't 32,500 PwC employees across the world. Those are members of the public from different industries.
Absolutely right. Yeah, they're, we've got a really, really broad sample of people from different sectors as well. And it's very interesting, isn't it? It's mixed reading. It's got a degree of positivity. I think people seem to be quite optimistic and excited about the future, depending on the background they're coming from. But there's also this degree of uncertainty, I think, around the viability of certain types of jobs as well. So this is probably not a new topic. We've done a lot of surveys looking at the impact of things like AI in my area in terms of job displacement. Does this lead to an automation of certain tasks that make up certain jobs? So that's a well-trodden path. But, you know, the headline that stood out for me was that 39% of people we surveyed think their jobs at risk of being obsolete within 5 years. And if that is the degree of your workforce with that level of concern, that level of uncertainty, that level of anxiety starts to surface. And I think that really does hold back businesses from an innovation perspective. And it has this detrimental effect on well-being and the level of certainty people have got. So how are we going to cope with this is really interesting. There's clearly got to be this huge global upskilling revolution now required to give people that level of skill set to prepare them for the future. We know there's a profound level of risk around discrimination and impact on equity across different sorts of professions. But I think now for the first time, I keep looking at these surveys we do year on year on year, we do CEO surveys. It feels now that there's possibility and more momentum behind making really big, profound changes. And this isn't just in the business models of businesses. I don't think it's just in the way that companies have a specific approach to a workforce strategy. But I think it cuts right across to the very purpose of businesses. We know we've got the COP climate conference in Glasgow this year. Climate change is top of mind for these for all companies now. We know that there's this ESG agenda starting to come through very, very loudly in a lot of the surveys in terms of top of mind for boards. And we know also that the staff are, there's a clarion call for staff to see businesses leading from the front around these big topics. And I see this coming through when we interview staff. We have these purpose statements. We have these lofty ideals about building trust and solving important problems and big commitments to net zero announced this year. And the best people we want to join us are holding us to account and asking us, how do you practically demonstrate you're going to do this? So I think there's a real burning desire now, I think, in businesses to start thinking about these mega trends and start thinking quite boldly about how to transform their businesses for this pretty uncertain new phase of work and business coming through.
Yeah. Are you finding that most of the ESG considerations that's being driven by younger members, younger people coming into the workforce?
I think it's certainly a driver, but I think there's also major drivers happening from a regulatory, a capital market standpoint, certain industries not seeing the same level of investment as before. So there's very clear commercial considerations and very, very big governance implications. So I don't think it's exclusively the new entrants to the workforce now. I think we're starting to see people from across the spectrum starting to dive into this narrative.
Not sure that I would really want to be a large organization CEO at the moment with so much to consider.
Yeah, you do have to wonder how far you want to go in business to think about the stresses and strains people are under at the moment. I think, though, for the right people, it's a really exciting time as well, isn't it? You know, you've really now got the mandate to do some big things. And I think the best leaders out there that I've got respect for are taking that chance and not just trying to deviate back to the old way of thinking. There was one of my brilliant colleagues on our global board, a guy called Blair Shepherd, and he talks about these different paradoxes of leadership that the best leaders now are going to have to face up to in this uncertain world. One of the ones I speak a lot about is needing to be a tech savvy and humanist at the same time. Someone that is absolutely on the money in terms of their own approach to digital upskilling, but they don't lose the humanity at the heart of how they look after their workforce. You think about people with kind of a globalist outlook, but a very, very close connection to place and the locality that they live within. We hear about people with a need to be traditioned in terms of the purpose of the business they're leading, but also innovators at the same time and able to press the business to drive real change. I'd certainly ask you to share the six paradoxes of leadership. It makes for quite an interesting thesis.
What now?
No. I thought you could stick it on your reading list or something. I don't know how you do it.
You touched on there about being a tech-savvy humanist. So in the world of AI, because traditionally when the layperson thinks of AI, we think of Skynet coming to just destroy us all. But in the business context, what does AI actually mean?
For the first time in quite a long history of this technology, which actually in theory has been around for several decades, we're in this situation where we've got such a huge amount of data in our businesses and in our lives. We've got significantly more economically available computing power in the cloud. And we've got some really interesting breakthroughs in terms of the applications of the technology. So for the first time, it's useful. It's providing real value. And it's not about those Skynet scenarios at all. I spent most of my life trying to debunk that these sort of utopian narratives about AI being this magic dust that takes away all our problems, or being this kind of a threat to society and civilization. On that side,
Alexa's going to kill me one day.
Yeah, well, that's on you, mate. You shouldn't be so rude to it. But the reality is that there's amazing possibilities absolutely happening now. So, for example, you know, incredible things happening in healthcare. It's played a part, for example, in helping to find new therapeutics for COVID-19. It's helped with the process of the vaccination development. Very, very close to my own heart, as you know, very sadly, I lost my mum, Kathy, to motor neurone disease. It was terrible, but you know, it was one of these things that was, it's a rare disease. It's got no treatment, but it's not widely impacting enough people to create that economic base to drive enough money into the R&D side of it. So there's AI now being applied to the clinical trials process to find new treatments. And there's one British company already starting to look at quite a promising drug intervention around motor neuron disease. So amazing things happening in healthcare. It's being applied to look at some of the grandest challenges we're all facing at the moment, what we call the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, things like climate change, deforestation, the whole education for all debate, you name it, AI is touching some part of that sort of value chain. We know it's offering also significant economic growth prospects. So a big study we did a couple of years ago suggested that as AI is applied to drive productivity growth, to drive consumption of goods and services, it unleashes this $16 trillion US dollar economic growth by 2030. So you can see how it drives, you know, things economically as well. But for all the good stuff, there's this equal and opposite side to the equation that's more of a negative impact. And if you follow the press, there's never a week goes by where there's not a real world impact around this technology, whether it's around the A-level marking situation last summer, that algorithmic driven outcome there. We've heard about it leading to bad outcomes in things like leading to discrimination in hiring and recruitment. We've heard about it leading to civil rights violations in the use of facial recognition software. So if you're sitting there in business, you're now thinking, well, this technology is now economically priced. It's able to solve real problems. We have to start thinking about how to adopt this to solve real problems now. But at the same time, we can't walk in blind. We also know that the adoption's accelerated, as I said before, due to the circumstances of the pandemic. And what this brings to the top is this list of specific considerations that I'm pressing upon all business leaders to take seriously now. So I think the top of the tree there is this very real issue around the fairness and bias evident in these systems. So the way you train these systems is, of course, dependent upon the data you feed into them. And unfortunately, these workforces building it are guys like me, white middle-class blokes. And unfortunately, the unconscious bias that seeps through leads to quite often a biased data set that leads to, therefore, a biased outcomes. And we're seeing this in all manner of case studies and press stories. We also have this consideration around some of the ethical aspects of this. Just because you can do this, is it something you should do? You know, there's been these applications around software that can read your micro expressions and gestures and features on your face and determine if you're a good cultural fit for this organization. You don't walk into these things, you know, blindfolded. You have to be mindful of the risks and have those questions to hand to understand, should you be doing this? We take it so seriously. I've got a full-time ethicist in my AI team. We look at these things, these unintended consequences. We have this very particular feature with AI that we talk about, the explainability issue. So the very, very advanced forms of AI are quite opaque. It's quite hard to understand how they've reached this optimal outcome. And the need, therefore, if it's like an outcome of significant consequence, so like the opposite of, let's say, a Netflix movie recommendation, you know, you're not going to lose too much sleep if you get a Duff movie recommended to you. But if it's recommending a particular treatment for cancer, or it's going to decide upon the outcome on your mortgage application, you want to know how it's reached that decision. Right. And the regulators will want to know how that comes to the surface. And there's even security implications now. So the one story which I always talk about is have you heard about these deep fakes? So using deep learning software, you can feed data into these platforms now and synthesize very, very lifelike audio and visual of people, celebrities, etc.
There's the famous one on YouTube and TikTok who's the Tom Cruise impersonator.
Exactly.
So many people saw that and they thought Tom Cruise, I mean, even I did, I thought, what the hell's Tom Cruise doing? Just running around the streets, just pulling pranks on people. But, you know, this guy had basically using a computer in his loft or whatever and taking hours and hours of footage of Tom Cruise from God knows how many, you know, films and whatever. And then just managed to kind of graft it surgically, digitally onto his face. And it was just so realistic. And you think of the potential for the abuse of that technology. Well, it's already happening. You know, we're a clean podcast, so I'm not going to go into that world. But it's already, the abuse of that technology is already happening.
Well, let me give you one precise example. You know, you can look at these Tom Cruise videos, think, yeah, that's amazing, and, you know, laugh it off. But these fraudsters actually took a load of audio of a chief exec speaking at conferences. They synthesized an incredibly lifelike version of his voice and got him to telephone his CFO and request a wire transfer for several hundred thousand dollars, which went through, and they managed to defraud this company out of this sizable sum using deepfake technology. So there's very real considerations there. And the list goes on around governance and around robustness of these systems. So this isn't just a kind of a technology conversation now. I spend most of my time talking to chairs and boards of companies from a governance perspective, HR directors looking at the workforce implications of this, the regulatory and compliance teams, and the list goes on. It's a very much a kind of a pan cross business type of debate happening now to get this done right.
You almost need to train an AI to work out how to train the AI.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast we can go into another time, but it's exciting prospects ahead.
You mentioned, if I may, you mentioned representation. What are the challenges that you're facing? I'm part of the Black Leadership Network, very new. It was only started up a few months ago. But what are you seeing in terms of recruitment, representation, people from minorities?
It's certainly there from an ethnicity point of view. I would say that gender is particularly stark. It's often as high as 80% male, these workforces.
Wow.
And now our team's a lot better, but still not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. So, and there's a lot of particular issues there. So one of the things that we did at PwC was a big survey a few years ago to look at we surveyed younger girls and boys to understand their preconceptions about a technology career. And literally, a small number of percentage of these girls could name a female technology role model, whereas the boys could rattle off plenty of male role models, Elon Musk and the likes, quite easily. But there were so many, and we're talking right at a tender age, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, had already discounted themselves from thinking about a career in tech. So this charter we've done, this Tech She Can charter, which I think 200 businesses have signed up for now, is really starting to build role models, advocate for it, and try to drive policy changes to get more girls into an early age. So there's definitely a homogeneity issue. And as I said before, this surfaces real risk in terms of tech that just does not lead to good outcomes. If the technology that we're building is not built by people representative of society at large, it will never be properly representative of society at large either. And that's a commercial impact as well. You're only ever going to service one part of your market. So there's very good commercial drivers to get this done, get it right.
So Rob, you've got used to this new way of working and looking at your attendees down a computer screen, a video camera. But we've got to get back to the real world eventually. What's coming up later this year? Because we are going to come out of lockdown and events are going to happen again. Absolutely sure of it. Is there anything that you've been booked in for that we can be excited about?
Well, I wouldn't say anything I'm involved with you should be excited about. I did get an invite to my first black tie event happening in September, which is rather exciting. To be honest, I'd be excited about an invite down the pub with a couple of the mates at the moment. But, you know, if it's black tie, even better.
Actually, we've got a black tie event for July.
Wow, that's pretty bold. We'll see.
Yeah, we only found out yesterday we've just won an award, but Carolina called me and she said, hey, we just had a call from, I don't know who it is, I'll find out, but we've won an award and there's a black tie event in July. And I said, you're kidding, really? Like, they're not joking, it's definitely going ahead. And she goes, yeah, there's some big fancy black tie do in Central. And I'm like, don't worry, yeah. I'm there. I'd like my tux, I've got it out, I've checked it over, it's steamed, it's pressed, it's ready to go.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, well, you know, let's see how that goes. But I think just in summary, like, people keep talking about this phrase, you know, the new normal, or get back to normal, or even more insultingly, getting back to work. You know, and you see the strain and stress of people have been under, actually, industriously beavering away in the home environment whilst homeschooling.
Yeah, what do you mean back to work?
Exactly.
I've been working harder than
Likewise.
I've ever worked
yeah,
before.
Exactly. So let's just park some of these silly narratives and actually look at the future. You know what? Increasingly, I'm feeling a modicum of optimism about where we go next. I think it's been such a profound shock to the system that I think businesses are now in the majority thinking of making some bold change for the better. So we just need to keep focused on that and try to avoid just slipping back by default to some of the things that weren't good before. And who wants to sit on a tube or a train for 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week, forever? I mean, I don't know what my schedule will look like, but it will look different. And I do hope it will be healthier, happier, and focused on more important things than things like commuting and the old way of life. So hopefully we can channel that spirit of positivity and lock in some really positive changes for the better.
Well, on that note of optimism, I think we'll bring today's conversation to a close. But this is just a fascinating area, and I'm sure I'm going to get people writing in and messaging me for us to do this again. So maybe we could do that later on in the year once you've had a chance to get back out there. And then we can expand some more, see where some of the predictions this month have ended up.
Well, speaking of expanding some more, that brings the whole suit fitting equation into play, doesn't it? So I've not worn a suit for a year. So expanding some more might not necessarily help out when I return to the office.
Yeah, well, apparently I'm going to be very busy on the alterations front because everyone's got fatter this lockdown. Rob, thank you so much. I really, really look forward to the day that we can actually meet in person again. I've missed you, but I really, really appreciate your time today. And I know that our audience is going to get so much out of everything that we've covered. Where can people find you?
So always on Twitter, @RobMcCargo, always on LinkedIn, and probably they're the two main channels, and your podcast, of course.
As always, I'll have all those links in the show notes for you. Rob, thanks ever so much. See you soon.
Thanks, my friend. Take care. Bye.
I really meant what I said to Rob. He's working in such a fascinating area, and I wish we'd had more time to expand on so many of the things we touched on in this episode. My thanks to Rob, and I hope you got some positive lessons and messages from our conversation. I love to hear from you, so please let me know your comments, thoughts, and feedback. That's it for another week. If you're enjoying my show, please do leave me a rating and review. It really helps other people discover me and give the show a go. And please don't keep us a secret. Remember to share us with your friends, family, and colleagues. This show might be just the positive addition to their lives that they need right now. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, just send me a DM on Twitter or Instagram, or email me via the website. You can find contact details in the show notes. Once more, thank you so much for listening and for your amazing support. I can't wait for you to join me on the next one.